On behalf of ITRC, welcome to today's training, part two of ITRC's Vapor Intrusion Mitigation. This class is the second of two sessions in this series and was developed as an offspring of the ITRC Vapor Intrusion Toolkit Guidance, which was published in January 2026. The link to the toolkit is now available in the chat for you to access. I have the pleasure of introducing our trainers today. They all volunteered their time over the years for many ITRC products, including developing and delivering this training. So thank you to our trainers. And with that, I'm going to turn this over to Jennifer Borski from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources to initiate today's training.
Thanks, Nicole. Just want to quick check, make sure you can hear me okay.
Great, Jennifer. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Okay, so before we get into the meat of what we're going to talk about today, I just wanted to give you a little bit of background. There were three ITRC vapor intrusion related guidance documents that were available before we put together this toolkit. The 2007 practical guide, 2014 petroleum vapor intrusion, and then the 2020-2021 VI mitigation training or guidance documents. So what the ITRC vapor team did is took all three of those guidance documents, we compiled them and updated them into a single VI toolkit that's shown on the right there. That toolkit is comprised of the primary guidance document, and then it's supplemented by a series of numerous fact sheets, technology information sheets, checklists, and also training resources. This toolkit really does provide the best practice and most defensible approaches to supporting VI data-driven decisions. So we encourage you to look at the VI toolkit as we go through the training today and follow along. This next slide is the roadmap that you're going to see throughout the training today. So today is session two. The topics that were covered in session one are up above. So today we have three different speakers that will discuss active mitigation, passive mitigation, and then we're going to talk through system verification to make sure those systems work, the operation monitoring and maintenance, curtailment or stepping down a system, and then eventually the shutdown. So before we launch into the details, we're just going to do a real quick vapor intrusion reminder. So before we begin, first we're talking about contamination that has been discharged or released into the soil or groundwater that can volatilize into soil vapor. So vapor intrusion occurs when these contaminants, the contaminated vapors, migrate up into the overlying buildings and contaminate the indoor air. And these vapors, when they migrate into the indoor air, if they're present at sufficiently high enough concentrations, these vapors could present a threat to the health of the building occupants, and that's really what our ultimate concern is here. So vapor intrusion addresses vapor-forming chemicals that include volatile organic chemicals, semi-volatile organic chemicals, pesticide compounds, elemental mercury, and most recently, per and polyfluoroalkyl alkyl substances or PFAS. The most common of those is the chlorinated solvents. And then a subset of those vapor-forming chemicals is petroleum vapor intrusion or PVI, and that really deals with exclusively the petroleum hydrocarbons. So one more reminder on what vapor intrusion mitigation is. There's multiple mitigation strategies that's also known as vapor control. These control can include a few things. The first couple we discussed in session one, and those include source remediation, where we address the source of those vapors, rapid response, where actions are taken really quickly to interrupt the pathway, such as HVAC modification, preferential pathway sealing, ventilation, limiting access, relocating, things like that. Also, institutional controls, that's where documents are recorded that would require continued operation of a system, for example, or the active and passive mitigation, which we'll discuss today, where we're physically installing those solutions to interrupt the pathway long term. So here's the roadmap. At this time, I'm going to turn it over to Catherine Regan with Haley and Aldrich to talk about active mitigation approaches. Catherine.
Great. Thanks, Jennifer. And happy St. Patrick's Day to any of you out there celebrating. Okay, I'm going to go through, as Jennifer just said, we're gonna stop here and talk about active mitigation approaches, some technologies that are commonly used to complete an active mitigation, and then the performance measurements that are specific to those active mitigation approaches that you would need to consider. And then at the end, we'll talk about a few of the design considerations, of which there are many, but just a few of them we'll highlight here that are specific to and important to active mitigation. So before I start, let's just do a little what is active mitigation? And specifically, what we consider to be active mitigation as part of the ITRC toolkit team. Jennifer just mentioned something like HVAC system modifications. Some might consider that to be active. But in our case, what we were deciding was active was this process, this continuous diversion of vapors from under the building. Oops, I clicked too many times. Get this back. From under the building, up through piping, and then to be exhausted outside. And they would do that via a mechanical means that is specific to the system. And that's sort of our narrower defined definition of active mitigation. So this active blower or fan you can see circled there on the cartoon picture, that is what is making these systems active, that mechanical means. And the other piece about active mitigation is that you have these physical quantifiable data that you can use to measure whether an active system is working or not. And some of those are listed here on the slide. And some of these I will go into in a little bit. But they are th th these are what we're going to use to see if the system is effective. The slides are a little slow. Sorry, guys. So first, before we go into any details, I will point you to our active mitigation fact sheet that is in our toolkit. And this is laid out. You can see a little snapshot of it there on the right. It's laid out as a summary guide to the contents that are in the rest of the active mitigation documents or work products. So there's quick summaries in here about common technologies, common enough that we created their own separate technology information sheets, or you'll hear me call them tech sheets, and those we'll talk about in a second. But there's also some descriptions in this mitigation fact sheet about lesser common technologies, but still ones that you might encounter. So we included some information about those in here as well. And you'll also see several times references in the document, in this document and in the tech sheets, to ANSI AARST standards, which are published standards out there that if you're looking to put, pen to paper on a detailed design, those might be what you want to look at to get some more specific standards for doing an actual design. So, let's start with one of the most common active mitigation approaches, which is subslab depressurization or SSD systems. And these, you can see the same picture we showed earlier, draw that air from beneath the slab using a collection point, in this case, this solar gas collection sump, through the riser pipe, and then it's vented outside into the atmosphere. So note here the location of that fan, the mechanical blower is outside of the building. This could potentially be, say, in the attic of the building, but the important feature here is that it needs to be outside of the occupiable building space. So if it's in an attic and then someone decides to turn their attic into their new home office, that would not work. It would need to be outside of that occupiable building envelope, we call it. These are systems you've probably heard of already. They're very common. They've been shown to be very effective both for things like radon. If I look out my window, I can see my little fan on my home working its way right, just right outside my window, for radon, but they also are very effective for vapor intrusion. So let's look a little bit more in detail at some of those primary components for a sub-sub depressurization system. So first, we have those holes that are, and this is kind of specific for a retrofit, so a building that already exists that you would be adding this system to. Although, and I'll get to this in a second, sub-sub depressurization can also be a new construction. So the first thing we would have would be these holes in the concrete floor. That are then sort of cored out, reamed out to create that suction point that you see under the slab. Then those would be connected to a vertical riser that would come off the suction point, and then that would connect to some horizontal conveyance piping, something to get that pipe outside of the building, either outside on the wall or outside on the roof. And then they would connect to that mechanical feature I mentioned before, the fan or the blower. In these two pictures, there's a smaller one on the left-hand picture that would be more type of inline fan for a house or a small system, but they can also be much larger fans, blowers that would be used for much larger systems and much larger buildings. And then lastly, some photos here on the bottom right that are some of the other ancillary activities that might need to happen in conjunction with putting in a system would be maybe sealing up cracks in the floor or sealing up existing sumps. Actually, in that picture where you can see the sump on the ground, they also had to repair the concrete floor by pouring sections of floor that needed to be added. So those are ancillary activities that often happen with sub-sub depressurization systems. And then some more photos here because photos are fun to look at. If we dive deeper into some of those additional components, you can see on the top left-hand picture that some equipment that will be used to control a system, like a gate valve or a ball valve. And then in that same group of pictures is a port in the pipe that you could use to take flow measurements or vacuum measurements or to pull a sample if you needed to. In the middle top picture is another component. It would be if you wanted to monitor vacuum of your system, you could transmit that vacuum via telemetry system, which is shown in that box in the picture in the center. That could either transmit information about systems being on or off, or actual levels of vacuum, or levels of some of the performance measurements that you could collect either in person or in this case, you could do it remotely. And then you could also have floor measuring points. That box on the top right is measuring differential pressure between the subslab and the indoor air. And we'll talk a little bit more about differential pressure later. And then the bottom of this slide is just a whole other laundry list of equipment that could be used that's more common if your system is very, very large. So that picture on the bottom right, if you can see behind that fence screen is several, I think four large carbon tanks that were part of a very large system that was used to depressurize and mitigate for very high concentrations in a subslab for a building. And things like that, like emission controls, carbon, or some of these other pieces of equipment may be based on both the size of the system and also potentially on your regulatory requirements. Every state is different about emission controls, so it's something to pay attention to. So I mentioned I was also going to talk about sub-sub depressurization and new construction. There is obviously some advantages if you don't yet have a building there where you have a lot of control over how the system is put in the subslab. You have control over the type of gravel that goes down under your building, type of base material, that where some piping or vent layers get put in, like you can see in the top picture and the far right picture. And whether the size and robustness of a membrane that gets put down above these gravel layers, but below the concrete. You have control over those features that will help your sub-sub depressurization system work. And as a result, that could ultimately lead to a positive cost impact. So if you're able to install a system during construction, ideally design it before construction and install during construction, you could have fewer inline fans, a smaller system, because it's operating in a underneath the slab in a controlled environment that you created. Versus if you had to come in afterwards and put a system in after a building is constructed, it may need to be a larger system, and certainly you would be installing it in such a way that you could be affecting or maybe aggravating going in while a building is being used. So there is a cost scenario there that would be a net positive impact if you could put the system in before the building is built. So moving on from sub-slab depressurization, there is a sort of a twin of sub-slab depressurization that's called sub-slab venting. And we have this as a separate tech sheet, but I will say this now, and I'll probably say it several times. It is very similar and has a lot of the same components and features and actions as a sub-slab depressurization system. So it's a variant, you could call it, of sub-slab depressurization. So it's similar, you can see in the cartoon there, in that it draws vapors out under the slab using a fan, some outside. But the one of the differences here is that that layer that it's pulling from, I've labeled here as highly permeable. So that gravel layer underneath the building, or perhaps the void space under the building, it's very easy for air to get drawn out of there, relatively speaking, easy for air to get drawn out of there and then replaced with other air, and ultimately reduces that overall concentration in the subslab. And that reduced concentration is what mitigates the potential for VI. So one important feature, if your system is working predominantly as a venting system like this, just that ease of pulling air out and getting and other air coming in, it could just generally generate less differential pressure, less vacuum than a depressurization system. So as a result, you would use other performance metrics to show that this system is effective. And the one that's pretty important is that one in bold on the slide, which is this reduction in subslab vapor concentrations. And one of the items I just mentioned that's kind of a key feature, can be a key feature of some subslab venting systems, is that layer underneath the slab. And sometimes that layer can be a void space. So for this new guidance document, if you read our previous 2020 VI mitigation ITRC document, this would be a new tech sheet that didn't exist then. And it's called the void space area to floor slash void space system, or VSS tech sheet. And this was created to call attention to these void space systems. It's really a component of a system versus a technology all by itself. But it was unique enough that we separated out a tech sheet for it. And it's obviously, you can see from this picture, likely more, it's more common in a new construction because it basically it replaces the subslab area underneath the concrete with these structural void forms. So you can see in the picture these giant sort of domes that are placed on the ground and concrete being poured on top of it. If you took a cross section of those, that's that picture on the far left. That's what it would look like. You'd be pulling air through your, or in this case, that orange is your pipe, your vent riser. You're pulling air through that void space up and out of the building. So these, you can see in the slides, as it could be used for SSD or SSV. They both, SSD and venting, both have fans, they both have pipes, they both bring air outside. What is the difference between the two? So we wanted to go through that on this next slide here. What is this difference between depressurization and venting in terms of VI mitigation? So I already said this, I'll say it again. They are kind of two sides of the same coin. The primary actions that make each system effective are kind of listed here on the slide. So with depressurization, the point is to create that differential pressure between the subslab and the indoor air so that impacted vapors cannot enter into the building. They want to go down and out, not up and in. For venting, sort of the primary mechanism that makes that effective is that air movement and the dilution of the subslab concentrations. And if your subslab concentrations are lower, then that will equate to a mitigation of vapor intrusion, so they won't go inside. So they probably are both happening to some extent on every site. Just matter which one is more dominant for your particular site and situation and conceptual site model and design objectives and all those things. So how would we measure them differently? Let's talk about those performance metrics or performance measurements that you would do potentially differently for depressurization versus venting. So these are sort of listed in order of most common to lesser common for each of the types of systems. And you can see the lists are kind of the same. They're just sort of ordered differently. So depressurization systems, that primary mechanism to show that it's working is this differential pressure versus venting, where your primary mechanism might be that you show that your vapor concentrations under your slab are going down. So let's talk about just those two. I know we don't have much time today, so we're just going to talk about the top performance metric for each of those types of systems. So first up is differential pressure. So differential pressure, and I want to kind of just normalize us all to get on the same page on what we're talking about when we say those words. You may or may not have heard them before, but it is exactly kind of how it sounds. It's the difference between the pressure under a building relative to the pressure in the building. And this is, specific for vapor intrusion. So we created these two cartoons here to keep us sort of consistent on what means what. So starting with the cartoon on the left, if the pressure is higher under the slab than the indoor air, then you've got pluses and minus. You can see on that big green arrow, then air wants to flow from high pressure to low pressure. So it wants to sort of push up, we'll say, into the building. And if you were to attach a differential pressure digital meter to a point that you have a sample port you have in the slab, to me, that reading would read positive. It would be pushing up from the subslab into the indoor air. And that reading can be in, whatever units you are using. In this case, I've written it out as an inches of water typical reading. So if you took that same house and you went to the picture on the right and you added a fan and started sucking air out from underneath the building and creating what I would call a negative differential pressure, then you're flipping your arrow. You now have a higher pressure inside your building than under your building. And again, air wants to flow from high pressure to low pressure. That same port in my sample, the same sample port in my concrete slab. Now I attach my meter to it, and I would see that as a negative reading. So in my mind, negative readings equal good because that means I have a negative differential pressure under my slab when compared to my indoor air. And obviously, other things can affect this differential pressure, like weather in an HVAC system, and whether you have a pizza restaurant in your strip mall and it has a huge vent hood on it. All those things will affect this differential pressure reading, and those are the things that your system, if you're putting a system in, need to overcome. So let's look at an example of what that looks like when that differential pressure is sliding down from generally positive readings to more consistently negative readings. So here's an example of how you could see something like a subslab depressurization system is working. So in this our same cartoon house is there, and you can see it on the far left under normal conditions. And if you were to be able to measure differential pressure sort of in quick increments over time, like with a logging machine, you would see that graph kind of go up and down. It changes all the time based on how a building is used and the wind and the weather and all that. But it's generally, in this case, positive. Say with a say the SSD system as the subslab depressurization system is in, but it's turned off, just for example purposes. And then about 15 minutes into our graph here, we turn the system on. And you can see that same sort of bopping up and down of the differential pressure, but it's dragged down on my graph so that even though this building is still being used and the weather is still happening and the wind is still blowing and doors are being opened and closed and stuff like that, I'm still getting all of those ups and downs in differential pressure, but they're all now in the negative range because my system is still making it more negative under the building than in the indoor air. So I've created that depressurized condition. And then, just turn the system off again, and then we kind of go back up to the natural condition here. So this is something that you can actually see happen on a site if you're installing a system, and logging this data over time is a tool. It's not always done, but it's a tool that you could have, and you can even transmit this kind of data via telemetry if it's something that you need to see on your site. And one of the advantages of having sort of real-time data like this allows you to see that, just because my points when the system is on maybe are sometimes less negative and sometimes more negative, it's all still generally negative. So your system is working despite the fact that the conditions sort of change over time, in every second of every day. So when you're looking at differential pressure, what would you think is a value that's enough? How much differential pressure do I need to say that my system is working? Several states have come up with numbers that they want to see as part of their guidance documents, and you can see some of those in that example table on the slide, and they're not all the same. There is no magic number like, oh, the number is 10. You gotta get to 10 and then you're good. There's lots of different numbers, and basically that's because different states have sort of put factors of safety around that, around the target number they give in their guidance. The point is that you want to stay negative in your differential pressure under reasonable operating conditions. The fact that in the wintertime, it may be harder to stay negative than it is in the summertime. So you want to have enough negative differential pressure so that you can maintain that depressurized condition under these reasonable under reasonably anticipated building conditions. So between summer and winter and spring and fall and weekdays and weekends, that kind of thing. So, that's a lot to say about differential pressure. That one is sometimes unique if you haven't dealt with active mitigation systems before. The next one, switching over to sub-sub venting that I want to go through, is this concept of vapor concentrations. And I'm going to do this using an example here. So say I have this sort of fictitious property, and I have one suction point labeled there on the figure, and I have these two probes, monitoring probes in the sub slab. And say I measure differential pressure at each of them, and I can see that negative differential pressure that we just talked about at point one, but I don't see it at point two, at VP point two. So if that was the case, and I was only using differential pressure as my metric of performance, then I would say, oh, my suction point only has enough influence to reach VP-1. That's it. But say I measured sub-sub concentrations at both VP1 and VP2 before the system went in, and then after the system went in when it was on, and I measured those over time. And say I could see measurable reductions in both of those points, then I could, as a sub-sub venting system, I could say, well, this point is actually influencing all the way out to VP2. My influence is bigger because I see that it's influencing VP2 because I see those reductions in concentration. And that would look something like this. So this is a graph of concentration over time at VP2. My system goes on, I can start to see reductions over time at VP2, and maybe the VP2 levels get below the screening level. So that's just a way to sort of conceptualize that concentration data is important, especially if your system is acting mostly as a venting system, because it will show that you actually have larger influence than maybe where you can measure differential pressure. So now it's time for a knowledge check, and it's going to be about sub-sub depressurization and sub-sub venting. So which building in this example, based on what I was just talking about, do you think is more amenable to be monitored as a sub-sub venting system? Would it be building A, where it has a high permeability gravel layer underneath our slab? Or would it be building B, where we have a low permeability, maybe a native soil, right underneath our slab? So I think Nicole opened the poll, got a 50-50 shot. There's only two answers. So we'll wait a couple seconds for folks to fill it out, and then we'll share the answer. Nicole, I'll rely on you to tell me when to close it out. Okay, I think it's closed. And yes, 89% got it correct. The building that would be more amenable to being monitored as a sub-sub venting system would be building A, because that gravel layer creates more permeability than tight native soil. And then you might have more of those concentration reductions, and that would be a good metric to use to see if this system is working as it was designed. So these two, the moving off of depressurization, sub-slab and sub-slab venting, we have two other tech sheets that are in our toolkit, and they're linked to there on the bottom, and they are sort of variations of the same. So these are submembrane depressurization, which is just like sub-slab, but instead uses a membrane and depressurizes under the membrane. And then crawl space venting, which is similar to sub-slab venting, but is venting the crawl space area versus the sub-slab. If you have, these are much more common in existing construction and much more common, obviously, for something like a basement or a crawl space. If you have the choice of using either, generally the sub-membrane is preferred as it's more effective and keeps you from being able to do your work underneath the membrane versus having to ventilate inside of a crawl space. But some crawl spaces are not accessible, are confined space, or really just are just not big enough for anyone to get into. So crawl space venting would be your option if that was the case. So that was a walk through our tech sheets. Those are the systems in their final form. But the question is, and something that we tried to answer with some of our documents in the toolkit, are how do you get there? How do you get to the point of having the system in that you want? How do we start the design? And we went through this in the toolkit using these process fact sheets. And the process fact sheets start with a fact sheet that I'm going to call the design considerations fact sheet, although you can see its name is much longer in the little snapshot of what it looks like on the right-hand side of this slide. But essentially, it's a guide through many of the considerations that you need to think about for various types of mitigation approaches, not just active, but all of them. And it one thing to note is that it's not set up to help you pick the mitigation technology that you want to use. That was sort of covered under the session one, but it goes through some of them. Once you know what you want to use, active mitigation, for example, it goes through some of those major considerations that you would want to think about as you were going through your design. And then a little reminder there on the slide is that we never want to forget about our VI mitigation conceptual site model, because that will be important in your design. And that we also, when you're thinking about your design, you want to make sure you're thinking about how you're going to prove that your design is working in the end, and how you're going to monitor it. So those are always keeping the end in mind is always a good idea. So next, I'm going to go through some of the factors to take into consideration in that design that are particularly important to active mitigation. And the first one, maybe is an easy one, is building type. Do you have a building, or are you looking at new construction? So this first one, if you have the design considerations for a new construction are clearly going to be very different than if you have an existing building. For new construction, you're going to be thinking about what can I have as that base layer? What size membrane do I need? Does it need to be, the thickness can vary depending on whether you want the system to go active as soon as it's done being built, or whether you are kind of roughing in the system and having it there in place in case it needs to go active at some point in the future. So those would be important for new construction. But if you had existing buildings, the type of design considerations for the building would be very, very different. So some of those would be listed here on the slide. I work a lot in old industrial manufacturing buildings that have been hodgepodge together since the early 1900s to now, that have many different foundations built many different ways. So knowing where and how each of those works and is located in the building is going to be really important for my design. How competent the slab is. So this picture on the bottom picture on the left is a suction point against a wall, but then you can kind of see in the floor these linear sealed cracks because the slab wasn't competent enough on its own. It needed to have its cracks sealed in order for the system to be effective. So those are going to be important for existing buildings. And then even the logistics, the picture on the right is how are you going to get that pipe out of the building? How are you going to get it up and vented outside? And how are you going to do it in the with aesthetics for how the building needs to look in the end and what the building owners would want for how it's going to look. So all those things plus many more are going to be important. And there's a checklist that we'll go through in a second that will help you sort of prompt your brain to think about some of those things. The other big design consideration feature for an existing building would be, you have no control or potentially knowledge over what's underneath that slab. So doing something that I'm calling here subslab diagnostics, you might hear it called a pilot study, you might hear it called a communication test, you might hear it called a pressure field extension test. All of them are the same thing in trying to give you some insight into the permeability of that subslab space. So again, something typical for existing buildings. You can set something up like this picture on the right where you basically test pull a test at a add some suction to a test point and then look to see if you can see differential pressure in different distances from that point. And that will help you know how many suction points you need. It will help you size your fan. And it will help you complete your design. And it may also help you figure out if you need to treat the exhaust stack in the end for your final design or not. So ultimately, the design will need to be completed, and you would figure out how many suction points and what the layout of those suction points would be, and how, if you're planning on doing the whole building or whether you're only planning on targeting a specific part of the building. So this figure on the right is showing suction points that basically target only where the impacts are. And the impacts are shown with those isoconcentration lines in brown and green. And in this particular example, the suction points were laid out to create sub-sub depressurization only where those impacts were. So that could be an option. That's part of your design considerations versus a whole building. Other things that you would put into your design considerations is, I think I just mentioned this, was whether you need to treat those vapors or whether you would like to put telemetry as part of your system, which is ultimately how are you going to monitor the system after you're done designing it and installing it. And this all would be wrapped up in your design documentation. And this is really important both for the consultant and design engineer to make sure they've documented why they've designed what they've designed. And then this also often rolls into documents that regulators will review. And in the case of the regulatory review, oftentimes the regulator is not reviewing your design and questioning whether you picked a 4-inch pipe or a 3-inch pipe or a 2-horsepower fan or a 1-horsepower fan. They're looking to make sure that your design basis makes sense. The design basis is explaining at your site why VI is occurring or potentially could be occurring, and how your mitigation approach is going to control that potential and how you're going to meet your design objectives. So they might be reviewing that part. They might be reviewing, did you consider how you're going to monitor your system once it's done? A preliminary OM&M plan. Did you properly engage with your stakeholders, like your property owner who wants the pipe on the back side of the building, not the front side of the building? Those are some of the features in design documentation that may be looked at by a regulator, for example, if they're not necessarily looking at the specifics of your design. So I mentioned a checklist. How are you gonna remember to look at all these things? There is, along with that design process fact sheet, there is this checklist. And this is new for the VI toolkit, is that there's a specific active mitigation checklist. I think it used to be combined with passive, and now we're two separate checklists. And there's just a whole bunch of stuff in there to jog your memory, remind you of the different considerations that you want to make sure either do apply, don't apply, or are just not applicable to your situation. Not all of them will apply to everybody, and certainly for smaller residential buildings, several of them won't apply at all. But this is sort of a list that could be used either formally or informally to make sure you've gone through the whole thought process when you're doing a d design. So that was a lot of information about active mitigation. But hopefully y'all kept up and kind of understood basically that first that definition of active mitigation, what's considered active mitigation, at least in terms of our ITRC document, some of those most common approaches and performance metrics, the fact that sub-sub depressurization and venting kind of both happen, and how you would do measurements to understand how both are performing. Or one versus the other, if it's one's more dominant on your site than another. And then just a little insight into active mitigation design considerations, depending on the type of building you have, and some of that design documentation, and how important that will be both for regulators and for the folks that are the PRPs on the site, and those that are going to have to install the system once it's designed. And in the way that it would work would, once we finally got through that design, we would install it. We'd verify that that was installed and operating correctly. And then you do however long you need to, this routine, or conduct continued O&M, operation, maintenance, and monitoring. And then down the road, if possible, you would monitor and plan for an exit strategy, some sort of closeout or shutdown of those systems. And many of these things are what are going to be touched upon by the next speakers that we have coming up. But I think before we get there, we have a quick question and answer break if we want to take any of these questions and answer them live.
Yes, thanks, Catherine. Give you a chance to catch your breath. Appreciate all the information that you have shared. So as a reminder, we are using the Q&A pod. So if you have any questions, need to make a comment or report a technical problem, please use that space to communicate with us throughout the training. We do have other ITRC team members in the background helping to answer some of these questions. So I wanted to thank them as well. We have a great group of people here working. So Catherine, I'm
Do you
going
want me to answer the
to
one question that's open still in
oh,
the Q&A
sure, go
pod?
ahead and do that one, and then I'm going to give you one more.
Oh, okay.
So go ahead, start with that.
Yeah, so I think there might have been a bunch of questions that were answered already, but the one that's still open in our Q&A pad is it possible to have a dead, quote unquote dead, sampling area where an installed vapor pin does not show any vacuum, even over multiple attempts at sampling? Would data collected from that point be representative of conditions under the slab in that area? I think it is certainly is possible to have areas that don't quite get either the vacuum that you want all the time, or the vacuum, or vacuum at all. If you think about that, if you think about that sort of vacuum propagation under the slab, we always show it as these nice circles, like I showed it on that example that was there, both examples. But it has to wrap around foundation footers potentially, and other tighter or looser soils in the space. So it's not going to be, it's probably more like an amoeba than a circle. So if that's the case, your point, it's possible for your point not to have any vacuum. If that happens, I think I would, sounds like maybe in this case, the point was, it was tried, it was maybe it was pulled out, cleaned out, put back in again. Just because one small spot doesn't have vacuum doesn't mean your whole system isn't working, right? It just either means that you need to use some multiple lines of evidence to prove that your system is performing adequately, or you need to move the point, or maybe you need to do some sampling instead. But it certainly is possible for you to have a dead point. I don't know if anyone else wants to come off mute to add to that, but you can think about it. And then it sounds like, Nicole, you have another question.
Yeah, appreciate it. So I was going to ask you to speak to a question submitted earlier. Can subslab vapor data be collected from the venting discharge if subslab sampling points are not available? Or would this data not be considered valid?
No, I think it's valid. I think it's a good point. I actually saw a presentation at Battelle a couple years ago where there was it was a sort of a empirical exercise to see how to correlate vapor data collected from subslab risers to say like a separated subslab sampling port, because some systems they just didn't install those singular sampling ports in the slab. They only have the riser data. So I think both have a place and a use. And certainly, if you don't have subslab ports, I wouldn't necessarily want to install one and potentially add a break in the membrane if there was a membrane there, just so you can get a different point. But you do have to know what you're collecting, right? So it that data that comes out of the riser is likely going to be more representative of an area versus of a single spot, since it's a collection of soil vapor from lots of different from like a a square footage area versus just a single location. So it's not invalid, it's just different, and you need to know how it applies to your site.
Thanks. We have some questions coming in here about differences between active and passive. So I think I'm going to take this time to let Catherine off the hook. We'll save some additional questions. We do have additional Q&A breaks, but this might be the right time to move us along in the training here to our second part of our talk. And Jay Eichberger with Michigan Department the Eagle is going to come on and talk to us about the passive mitigation approaches. So hopefully we'll get through some of those questions as well.
Thank you, Catherine and Nicole. Let's start discussing passive mitigation technologies in the mitigation process. During this training module, I will define passive mitigation, discuss common mitigation technologies, introduce key considerations for system design, installation, and planning, and we'll end with a discussion of construction quality control measures. At the conclusion of today's presentation, you should be familiar with a range of mitigation technologies, how to select a mitigation approach for your site, and how to ensure proper system installation. Passive mitigation does not rely on mechanical means, such as radon fans or vacuum blowers, to capture vapor-forming chemicals or VFCs. This is done by blocking migration of vapor-forming chemicals using chemical diffusion, and by relying on mechanical, I'm sorry, on and by relying on natural mechanisms such as pressure gradients to divert vapor-forming chemicals around the building envelope. When we think of passive mitigation, we typically think of passive barrier systems. Today, we'll be discussing three common varieties of passive barrier systems. These include composite membranes, or CM, single sheet membranes, or SSM, and epoxy floor coatings, or EFCs. There are differences between these types of passive barrier systems, such as the materials used and the installation methods employed, but they all block VFCs from entering the building through the vapor intrusion pathways. Ultimately, site conditions should drive the selection for the type of passive barrier system used. I want to encourage each of you to engage with mitigation system vendors and regulatory agencies early in the design process. Doing so will help ensure selection of an appropriate barrier system and help reach regulatory goals more efficiently. We'll start with composite membranes or CMs. These systems typically consist of a base layer, an asphalt latex material or ALM, and a cap sheet. The materials used in the base layer and the cap sheet can vary, but they usually consist of either a thin plastic membrane backed with a geotextile fabric or a single sheet membrane. The base layer provides a surface for the spray-applied asphalt latex to adhere to, and the cap sheet provides protection to the barrier system from rebar and concrete. The core of the CM is spray applied and it cures in place. The end result is that this creates a seamless layer of protection. The cap sheet creates a bond between the barrier and the concrete slab. This application does not require use of mechanical fasteners or caulking at penetrations. The overall thickness of the CM is measured in mils. The product manufacturer can recommend the most appropriate thickness for the asphalt latex material or ALM layer. Next up is single sheet membranes or SSMs, which may be comprised of one or more materials in sheet form, such as high density polyethylene or HDPE, linear low density polyethylene or LLDPE, ethyl vinyl alcohol or EVOH, or metallized films. The types of material or materials incorporated into a single sheet membrane can result in improved durability and increased chemical resistance. A single sheet membrane can be effective for a wide range of contaminants. During the installation process, sheets of the membrane material are overlapped and the seams and penetrations are sealed using a variety of methods, such as heat welding, spraying, or taping. The installation methods will vary depending on which materials are used. Each product manufacturer provides specific instructions for their product. The photo on the right is an example of seams of a single sheet membrane being sealed using a spraying method. Single sheet membranes are often not as durable during construction process as composite membranes or CMs. For instance, if you're installing a 20 mil SSM over a gravel layer, placing a layer of geotextile fabric under the single sheet membrane is prudent to prevent against punctures. In most cases, composite membranes or single sheet membrane barrier systems are utilized in new construction applications. But what happens if you want to mitigate an existing structure? That's where our last category of passive barrier systems comes in. Epoxy floor coatings or EFCs can be applied on top of an existing floor slab as a passive vapor barrier. EFCs used for vapor intrusion mitigation are specifically formulated for this type of application. The condition of the floor slab and the surface preparation can affect the overall quality of the EFC application. The concrete must be clean and dry, and the surface must be scarified or abraded to ensure a strong bond between the EFC and the concrete surface. EFCs provide a strong, durable, and chemical-resistant barrier. They can be installed in a variety of building types, and they're easy to clean and maintain. And since they're installed on top of the concrete floor slab, any damage to the floor coating is easy to identify and repair. They're also offered in a variety of colors and finishes to meet aesthetic and function needs, such as a slip-resistant finish. However, scarification of the concrete is required prior to EFC application to ensure a strong bond between the EFC and the concrete surface. The surface should be inspected periodically for damage. EFCs also require special preparation of concrete to control moisture content. If the concrete is too moist, it can result in delamination of the EFC from the concrete floor slab. Next, we'll discuss a few common types of passive venting systems, such as passive subslab venting systems and aerated floors. Three examples of common materials used in the construction of passive subslab venting systems are shown on the slide. From left to right, we have perforated PVC piping. In the middle, we have a trenchless geocomposite, which is commonly known as low-profile matting. And lastly, we have an aerated floor void space system, or VSS, which we discussed during the active mitigation module. Let's start with a passive subslab venting system. Vapor-forming chemicals, or VFCs, that accumulate beneath the building flow through a permeable layer of sand or gravel. The VFCs are captured within horizontal runs, piping, or matting, and then they're routed through vertical vent risers where they are discharged above the roof of the building. In order to achieve flow, these venting systems rely on wind effects, thermal effects, and pressure differences. And I can't stress this enough, but these venting systems tend to breathe both in and out. This type of venting system is almost always used in combination with the passive barrier system. The photo on the right shows an example of a passive subslab venting system, and gravel is used to create the permeable layer. Bear with me with these advances here. A collection network of horizontal PVC piping is installed within the permeable gravel layer. An opening, or collection plenum, is shown where the collection network connects to a vertical vent riser. And lastly, a vertical vent riser or exhaust vent is connected to the collection plenum. The exhaust vent in this photo is capped to protect it during the building construction phase, but it will ultimately be extended to terminate above the roof of the building. Under the right conditions, a passive subslab venting system can capture VFCs over a large area. Their simple design avoids the need for intensive operation maintenance and monitoring, or OM&M, after the system is installed. However, compared to an active venting system, a passive subslab venting system may require a greater number of vent risers, and it may have reduced performance in some applications. The key here is to understand that the mitigation needs based on site-specific conditions, such as the contaminants, the concentrations, and the building construction. The other type of venting system we've discussed today is an aerated floor void space system, or VSS. As described during the active mitigation module, this type of system typically uses a network of plastic forms placed prior to pouring the concrete floor slab. Once the concrete floor slab is poured, the forms create a void space beneath the concrete floor slab. There is very low resistance to airflow in these void spaces beneath the floor slab compared to other types of venting systems that use a permeable layer such as sand or gravel. This allows for higher air exchange rates beneath the floor compared to other types of venting systems. The plastic forms are connected to vertical vent risers. When vapor-forming chemicals enter the void space, they are routed through the vertical vent risers where they're ultimately discharged above the roof of the building. Aerated floors can rely on either passive or active venting, which is the reason why we've discussed them during both training modules. Void space systems may be less applicable to retrofitting existing buildings rather than use in new construction, unless higher floor elevations can be accommodated within those existing buildings. The last category of passive mitigation we'll discuss is building design. The design of a structure can be used to mitigate vapor intrusion risks or prevent vapor intrusion from ever occurring. For example, parking garages are usually constructed in city settings where space is limited. They are designed to prevent the buildup of vehicle exhaust by increasing air exchange rate within the parking structure. In some locations, air exchange rates are specified by the building code. And in these cases, documenting that required air exchange rates are being maintained may be sufficient to address vapor intrusion risks for a parking structure. However, these details should be confirmed with the appropriate regulatory agency. Other forms of building design, such as raised foundations and crawl spaces, can address vapor intrusion concerns for smaller buildings. Raised foundations are usually found in areas prone to flooding. The use of block and beam or podium style construction to raise a building off the ground separates the building from the vapor source and cuts off the vapor intrusion pathway. But more often, we'll encounter houses with crawl spaces rather than raised foundations. The concept used for the parking garage is the same for buildings with vented crawl spaces, it's just a smaller scale. Increasing the air exchange rate within the crawl space can help to prevent the buildup of vapor-forming chemicals. This can be achieved using natural ventilation, which is passive mitigation, or by incorporating fans into the design if adequate air exchange rates can't be met, which would be active mitigation. Regardless of the mitigation approach you select, whether it's active, passive, or some combination of both, be sure to check with the applicable state and a regulatory federal regulatory agencies about requirements when considering implementation of any of the mitigation approaches we've discussed today. To quickly recap, we have defined passive mitigation, how it works, and introduced you to several different passive technologies you can use to mitigate vapor intrusion. Now what? Let's assume you're working on a project where you want to implement a passive mitigation. And you've selected one of the passive mitigation technologies we've just discussed. At this point, there are three potential paths usually taken when implementing a vapor intrusion mitigation system. In the absence of any regulatory oversight, the project team might choose to figure it out as they go. A general contractor is told that they need to add a vapor mitigation system and is provided with a letter noting the basic requirements, but no formal design. Or specific plans are developed to inform all parties how the vapor mitigation system will be installed. To properly install a vapor mitigation system, the first two options will most likely lead to a less than desirable result, and those approaches are discouraged. We will focus our discussion on the path that will lead to the successful implementation. Now let's shift our focus to information about the best practices in the design, installation, and quality assurance quality control of passive mitigation systems. Fortunately, ITRC has developed many resources on this topic. When beginning a vapor mitigation system design, it is important to first establish a basis for the design. Basically, how was it concluded that passive mitigation approach is appropriate? A design basis document needs to explain how vapor intrusion is occurring based on the conceptual site model that we discussed during training session one. The explanation should then include the selected technology and how the selected approach will meet mitigation objectives. Next, a set of plans should be created that reflect the basis of the design document. The VIMS plans often contain product specifications, job-specific detail drawings, and QA/QC guidelines. An example of a VIMS design drawing, is provided in the figure on the right. Keep in mind that these details will be site-specific. A common question is, why are VIMS plans important? The selected mitigation system needs to be incorporated into the building, and in order to implement the VIMS plans properly, a number of different construction trades need to know what is going on. Construction can be organized chaos, and all of the trades responsible for the VIMS implementation need explicit instruction on what to do. In order to provide this explicit level of instruction to the construction team, a detailed plan set will show how and where the system components will be installed. This is especially important in areas such as slab penetrations, membrane termination points, and the placement of vent system components. For passive or active vent systems, the location of vent piping or matting, vent risers, and monitoring points should be identified in the design drawings. Performance testing can mean many things. For example, a diffusion coefficient is a good performance indicator of a passive barrier product's ability to be protective against a vapor-forming chemical. This information should be included with the mitigation system design documentation. Once the design is complete and prior to the installation of the mitigation system, the VIMS designer should confirm that a pre-construction meeting or pre-con is planned with all the trades involved with the installation of the mitigation system. This should include the VIMS designer, product manufacturers, and specialty installers, but most importantly, and I can't stress this enough, but most importantly, the general contractor, concrete and rebar installers, plumbers, electricians, and architects whose work may affect the vapor mitigation system installation. The pre-con is a formal review of the site conditions prior to installation. This means reviewing the mitigation plans to confirm they reflect the actual site conditions and confirming any other aspects of the mitigation plan with the construction team. Other aspects include substrate requirements, the ventilation layout, and the location of vent risers and utility penetrations. QAQC procedures, as well as the frequency and duration of installation oversight, should be agreed upon during the pre-con meeting. It is critical that these requirements are agreed upon before construction starts. At the end of the meeting, the general contractor and the other trades should be clear on what is needed to install the system correctly, how to sequence the installation with the other trades, and the importance of the system in protecting human health. Taking the time to conduct a pre-construction meeting will dramatically increase the likelihood that the system has been installed in accordance with the mitigation objectives. QAQC is very important with any mitigation system, but it is especially important with passive mitigation approaches. As noted, these procedures should be selected during the design phase so they're incorporated into the design process. Sources of QAQC guidelines include the manufacturer's requirements, regulatory requirements, and the site-specific needs. Some common ways to verify system installation include smoke or tracer gas testing, coupon sampling to measure the barrier thickness, and oversight documentation. Oversight documentation is a formal way of recording that the proper QAQC procedures have been conducted. For example, passive barriers are constructed in the field and installed prior to pouring a concrete floor slab. Each barrier system should have installation specifications and quality control procedures in place to test the integrity of the seams, the seals around penetrations, system termination points, and the overall membrane integrity. An example of passive barrier QAQC testing is shown in the picture on the right. A smoke test is being conducted to ensure the system is vapor tight. Non-toxic smoke is pumped underneath the membrane to help identify deficiencies that may not be identified by the naked eye. When reviewing passive mitigation approaches, there are some considerations for new versus existing structures. For new structures, the mitigation system design can be incorporated to be installed during the construction of the building. But for existing structures, the mitigation system must work around existing building conditions. New construction provides a clean slate and makes it easier to evaluate and plan for the implementation of the VIMS system. Regardless of what type of system is utilized, planning and construction oversight is a very important step in the process and is required to assure the system is installed per the design. The planning and resulting VIMS design should be used to help coordinate with the project team and subsequent trades. This design should be part of the building plans to aid in managing the system in the future, especially if adjustments need to be made once the building is in operation. A key advantage in new construction is the ability to combine any of the passive mitigation systems we've discussed today in order to create redundancy. In contrast, existing buildings do not provide the same level of flexibility that comes with new construction and can make evaluation and planning more challenging. This may limit the options for passive mitigation technologies that you could use. The key consideration in incorporating a mitigation system in an existing building is having an understanding of the existing foundation and how it can impact the mitigation design. Building modifications may be necessary in order to incorporate a passive design. If the original plans of the building exist, also known as the as-built drawings, they may help to identify some of the unknowns associated with the existing building and make the planning process easier. However, since a building is already in place, it can still take considerable time to understand how the building foundation might impact any form of mitigation. The active mitigation group provides more information about how to address these existing conditions. Regardless if passive or active mitigation is selected, BIM's plan should be used to document how these systems will be installed. So why is QA/QC important, you might ask? We've provided several real-world examples of QA/QC issues that can arise on a project. The photo on the left shows an area where a plumber relocated a toilet, resulting in damage to the underlying vapor barrier. The photo in the center is an example of a membrane that peeled away from a concrete wall after installation. This condition was identified during QA/QC inspections and was able to be repaired prior to pouring the concrete floor slab. The photo on the right is an example of an epoxy floor coating delamination. Good QA/QC practices can help to prevent these types of situations from happening and help identify and correct these types of situations if they occur. Let's see if we've done a good job providing a focused explanation of the design process. Time for a knowledge check. What is the most important element of a good design? Is it letting the project team know you want passive mitigation? Understanding basic requirements with no formal design? Figuring it out as you go? Or developing a formal design and implementing proper planning? I'll wait for the poll to close. Ninety-eight percent. That's fantastic. 98% of you gave the correct answer, and that correct answer is D. Developing a formal design and implementing proper planning. Excellent. So, what did we learn during this module? We defined passive mitigation and how it does not rely on mechanical means to mitigate vapor intrusion. We introduced five major categories of passive mitigation systems, including passive barriers, epoxy floor coatings, passive subslab venting systems, aerated floors, and building design. We then discussed key elements of a VIMS design and how planning is critical to achieving the mitigation goals. Last, we discussed the importance of construction quality assurance and installation oversight and appropriate documentation. Mitigation systems are installed for a reason, and it's important to get them right the first time. What else is on the horizon? Other ITRC training modules will help you better understand the next step in the process. The following topics are covered in the next training session.
Thanks, Jay. We have completed our passive mitigation section with Jay and see that he answered many of the open questions that we had on the difference between active and passive mitigation. We're going to take a moment and see if we have any other questions get submitted. And then give Jay a moment to catch up on the questions and see if there's any there that he wants to respond to. As a reminder, at the end of this training, I'll provide a link to a feedback form. You can complete the form, and in the bottom right corner, you certify that you participated, and you can receive a certificate of completion for today's training in your email.
I'm curious if we want to answer the question about can we use a combination of the barrier systems, and are there any pros and
Absolutely.
cons? I'm wondering if we want to tap one of our vendor friends for this one. If not, I can try to field it. Stacy, do you want to take a shot at answering this one?
Yes, Jay, I can help out here. The use of a combination of barrier systems, typically the overall plan or design, you have to also look at the different building elements, the foundation elements, as well as the concentrations, possibly where the contamination will be underneath the building or not. So there's different systems or different materials can be utilized for different areas underneath the structure, but you also want to consider the compatibility of those systems. You typically want to stay, I would say, with a single manufacturer for the different systems underneath the structure, typically, so that there's compatibility is known. And the performance too aspects of the different barrier systems. What is the overall performance criteria for that zone or that area that you're looking for? For example, if it may be a depressed area, depressed slab or foundation area versus slab on grade, and you might be able to utilize two different systems, one that's more provides more waterproofing positive protection too in the depressed area, whereas another membrane type or barrier system that does not have to rely or provide high pressure waterproofing performance during a saturated soils, or if it's just built into the water table as part of a lower slab area. So yes, there's means to go ahead and utilize different barrier materials.
That's great. Thanks, Stacy. Matt and Catherine, you want to?
Yeah, I was going to try to talk a little bit about, there's a couple questions in there about active versus passive and how a lot of the
Absolutely.
components for, one of them was about the components for passive seem like the same as for active, with the exception of the electrical fan or blower. And that is true in some cases. So for a existing building, right, it's very difficult unless you're planning on pulling up the floor and redoing it. It's very difficult to put those passive components into an existing building without too much full renovation efforts. So in those cases, that would kind of be active as your only option. For new construction, for sure, exactly what you hit upon in your question is exactly the point. Is that and often the benefit of active in those cases is that you can rough in the active and essentially leave it off. So essentially do a passive system. You got either those void space forms and the membrane, and really the addition is the piping and the riser piping that's sitting there and potentially off. That would be the passive system. And then if you do need to turn it on for various reasons, there's multiple reasons why you might make that decision to do so. Everything's there, and it's about adding the fan to it. I think you hit the commonality on the head, where there's lots of things that are common amongst these two approaches. And then someone asked what the best passive system would. I lost the thread of the question. Oh, is there a type of passive system that could be more easily be turned into an active system than other types? And again, it kind of the thing I just described. So it'd be difficult to turn just a vapor membrane into an active system without actually having to then poke a hole in it to put in piping and the fan and the vapor monitoring points and stuff. So the best system that is going to go from passive to active would be one that already had the vent piping. Again, this is for new construction. the vent piping in the gravel layer, underneath the membrane, and all the vapor monitoring points already in there. And then all you would need to do is put a fan, say, on the roof, for example. So that would be the best type. I think it also, I think we call it a, there's also the void space system that would have that pipe, that riser piping already installed. Those would be the best to go from passive to active.
Thanks. Matt, any additions to that? I know you had some.
No, I think that was great. Couldn't have said it better.
Sounds good. Okay, well, I think in the interest of time, we're going to keep moving. If there's some other questions here, we can come back at the last Q&A and pick up some more questions. But since I pulled Matt in, let's move on to system verification, OM&M, curtailment, and shutdown with Matt Jenny.
Good deal. Hey, everybody. So this module summarizes the recommended best practices to maintain the integrity of a mitigation system over time. The post-installation verification fact sheet is targeted toward short-term, whereas OM&M, or operations maintenance and monitoring, is focused on long-term stewardship. The final component of this third module presents a new fact sheet providing a framework to reduce ongoing VIMS operations and monitoring over time, and potentially support system shutdown if sufficiently justified. Bear with me as it's changing. There we go. Planning and intentional communication are essential to the long-term success of a vapor intrusion mitigation system. Short and long-term mitigation considerations should start at the design stage and continue throughout the life of the system. To the extent practicable, it is a good idea to establish performance monitoring metrics, or at least the conceptual options for evaluating system performance during the design phase of the project. The plans should be communicated with the appropriate project stakeholders as they are developed and updated over time. Further, the design stage is also an important time for considering approaches for curtailment or eventual shutdown if desirable. These considerations should not stop at the design phase because the site data, the VICSM, regulatory environment, and system performance may change over time. And so, while it is recognized that the specific long-term OM&M, curtailment, and shutdown plans of a mitigation system are often difficult to predict at the onset of a project, it's important to remember the decisions that are made at the early stage often affect the long term. Catherine mentioned earlier, begin with the end in mind. That's the concept. So, a key theme that applies to this module is the importance of planning and maintaining an appropriate level of communication with key stakeholders for the duration of a project. So now on to the first of the three fact sheets we're covering in this third section of the module. So the purpose of post-installation verification is to confirm the VIMS was installed and is operating as designed. And so this could consider the observations made during construction quality assurance, or CQA, the results of a post-construction building survey for retrofit buildings, which may be compared to a pre-construction building survey to understand the potential implications on VIMS operations. It may also consider VIMS commissioning and balancing, which could include that diagnostic testing or pilot testing that Catherine referred to evaluate sub-slab influence for active systems. And system adjustments of flow and pressure may also be appropriate at this stage. The results of this post-installation verification sampling provide confirmation the VIMS is operating as designed, and the testing should confirm your understanding of the VICSM or highlight the need for potential updates to the VICSM. And this initial performance testing provides baseline information for future OM&M. So now we can move on to the nuts and bolts of the post-installation verification fact sheet. A Harvey Ball rating table has been prepared summarizing key considerations for VIM system verification approaches. And this rating table is very familiar, very similar to the 2020 version of the ITRC VI mitigation fact sheet. The impact of different evaluation metrics are presented in the table, subdivided by mitigation approach. In other words, for active passive mitigation, which we talked about today, session one of the training discussed remediation and rapid response mitigation approaches. It's important to keep in mind that these impact factors are relative, they're not quantitative. Within the fact sheet, a narrative is included to supplement this table. So, for example, the pressure field extension testing, it's a common performance testing metric. So, as you can see on the table to the right, pressure field extension or PFE testing has a high impact on the evaluation of most active mitigation systems, particularly sub-slab depressurization systems. Also has a high impact on SVE systems that are intended for both remediation and building mitigation. Conversely, PFE is a rarely used metric for the evaluation of passive mitigation approaches and has a low impact on most rapid response measures such as ad hoc ventilation or indoor air treatment. The supporting narrative that accompanies this table, which it's not shown on the slide, but it explains what, in this case, pressure field extension is and provides a discussion of why each of these metrics are important or are not important for a given mitigation approach. So this next slide shows some of the most common system performance metrics discussed in the fact sheet and mentioned in several of the mitigation-related fact and technology information sheets or the tech sheets. So as discussed on the previous slide, differential pressure measurements above and below the slab is a common metric for sub-slab depressurization systems. System vacuum and airflow are often used for both SSV, so the subslab ventilation, and the SSD systems. Subslab vapor and indoor air sampling can be implemented for various technologies. And tracer gas testing, such as helium tracer gas testing using interwell tests, which are discussed in the fact sheet, can be used in a variety of scenarios and system types. And so the fact sheet provides information on each of these approaches and more. There's also a post-installation verification checklist, which you see here, the first page on the right, a snippet of it on the right. And that's to encourage documentation. Accurate record keeping is critical for short and long-term VIM stewardship. So here's an image of the checklist, and it provides a field-ready template that can be used for multiple system types. SSD, as in depressurization, SS subslab ventilation, passive barrier systems, for example. And it can be easily adjusted to fit project or regulatory specific needs. The checklist includes VIM's CQA considerations, but users should be aware that the VI toolkit includes a separate VIM CQA fact sheet and a VIM CQA plan outline that dives into greater detail on important considerations for VIM's CQA, which Jay also mentioned a lot of that in the previous module. So now it's time for a knowledge check, the first of two. And as it comes up, here we go. The question at hand is, when is it most important to develop post-installation verification procedures? During the investigation? During mitigation design and planning, at the time that you begin implementing your approach, after construction, or never. All right, pretty good. 87% during mitigation, design, and planning. That is right. So I'm either a pretty good teacher or not. I don't know. But 87% is pretty good. So with that, we are going to move on to the second phase of this module as soon as the slide pops up. Okay, so this piece focuses on VIMS operations, maintenance, and monitoring. The fact sheet stresses the importance of preparing an OM&M plan. It provides key considerations for long-term OM&M, and it highlights the importance of confirming the VIMS is operating as designed and is still protective of the building occupants over time. So similar to the VIMS post-installation verification fact sheet, the Harvey Ball impact scoring system has been retained, which we'll see in another slide. And there's also a supporting OM&M checklist. The main question we're trying to answer in the first fact sheet we discussed in the third section of this module, VIMS post-installation verification, the question is the VIMS working? The main question we're trying to answer when performing VIMS OM&M is the VIMS still working? So when evaluating VIMS performance, using multiple lines of evidence is an important strategy. Based on the data that is collected over time, it's important to evaluate that data, inform the applicable stakeholders if system operational changes are warranted, and repair, modify, or upgrade the VIMS if needed. And so with consistent and sufficient data, certain buildings may warrant consideration to reduce monitoring, transition from active to passive operation, or support system shutdown. These concepts are detailed in VIMS curtailment and shutdown fact sheet, which is covered as the final module in VIMS session two. So the VIMS OM&M fact sheet updated the Harvey Ball relative impact table and supporting narrative from the 2020 ITRC VI guidance document. The fact sheet summarizes key considerations for VIMS OM&M for multiple mitigation approaches. At the bottom right of this slide shows the example narrative that supports the table. In this case, the narrative explains the importance of clearly defining the purpose and objective of the VIMS for active and passive mitigation approaches in a VIMS OM&M plan. So to supplement the fact sheet, the toolkit includes an OM&M checklist. Like the post-installation verification checklist, this is a field-ready checklist that can be used for multiple system types, SSD, SSV, passive approaches, for example. And it's intended to be used as a guide or a template that can be adjusted as needed to fit project or state-specific needs. As you can see in the example image from the toolkit, the checklist provides primary prompts for the user to consider for a given category. So the primary prompt in the example shown is from section 3.1 and asks, was the mitigation system functioning as designed and operating upon arrival? Below the primary prompt, users will see conditional or secondary prompts to help guide the appropriate next steps. So for this example, if it's determined that the VIMS is not functioning as designed, then the secondary prompts indicates it is important to document and explain the finding, then use the OM&M plan or other resources to make appropriate corrective action measures. Moving on to the next fact sheet. The VIMS curtailment and shutdown fact sheet is new. It provides a framework for long-term VIMS decision-making, specifically related to VIMS curtailment, which means reduction, and VIMS shutdown, as in the termination of ongoing OM&M. The fact sheet presents flowcharts, tables, and a conceptual scenario to help users evaluate three common long-term VIMS stewardship objectives, which we will cover in the next slide. An example curtailment plan outline is also included in the appendix to the toolkit. The fact sheet emphasizes that any potential VIMS modifications should be justified based on data, specifically multiple lines of evidence collected for more than a single event. So users are encouraged to view this fact sheet as a tool to help reduce regulatory, environmental, and financial burdens on sites in which the VICCSM and data demonstrate vapor intrusion is either under control or no longer a health concern to the public, which will allow attention to be focused on higher risk sites. When it comes to VIMS curtailment and shutdown, the three most common project objectives that we defined in the fact sheet are a reduction in monitoring scope or frequency, a transition from active to passive operation, or a transition to VIMS shutdown. The fact sheet is a framework tool, though. It is not intended or designed to satisfy every site condition. Instead, it's focused on fundamental principles to evaluate if a given objective is technically defensible for a given site. And so, while it is possible that a VIMS progresses linearly through each of these steps, one and then two and then three, that may not necessarily be the case in each situation, but the concepts still hold. So, as mentioned on the previous slide, the use of MLE is fundamental to curtailment and shutdown. Some of the most common performance monitoring metrics referenced in the fact sheet include the collection of chemical data, differential pressure data, modeling, the development of building-specific attenuation factors, mass flux-based testing. So these metrics and others are explained in the post-installation verification and MLE fact sheets, which we recently covered. And so finally, when included within this is a conceptual large building curtailment and shutdown scenario. And that provides additional context to the framework tables. So again, the fundamental principle of this fact sheet is to use multiple lines of evidence over multiple events to evaluate and justify curtailment or shutdown. This means it is important to develop and evaluate a strategy early. Evaluate the performance of the VIMS over time. Use multiple lines of evidence to support the changes and communicate and plan with pertinent stakeholders throughout the process. The image on the right is an example flowchart for a site aiming to reduce monitoring scope or frequency. It walks through key threshold questions to help evaluate whether site data support a reduction in monitoring scope or not. So now it's time for the last knowledge check. And the question is, which is the most important data, or what is the most important data to use to support VIMS curtailment and shutdown? Is it the data from the first event, the last event, the differential pressure data, or multiple events over multiple lines of evidence over multiple events? Okay. Multiple lines of evidence, 97%, that's great. Over multiple events should drive decision making. Okay. In this training module, we discussed the key concepts from the post-installation verification, the VIMS OM&M, and the VIMS curtailment and shutdown fact sheets. The documents highlight the importance of long-term planning early in the project lifecycle. Post-installation verification is mostly geared to the initial testing following construction, used to provide baseline information for longer-term VIMS stewardship. VIMS OM&M is focused on upholding the integrity of the VIMS over time and collecting, as appropriate, data that can be used to evaluate if a reduction and eventual shutdown of VIMS is technically defensible. And then this leads to the VIMS curtailment and shutdown fact sheet, which provides a framework tool and fundamental principles for stakeholders to follow when evaluating when or if VIMS OM&M can be terminated. The VI toolkit provides different resources to use, including field checklists and example outline plans that can be modified to fit project or state-specific needs. And that concludes our last training slide for Vim session two.
Thanks, Matt. Great. So, as a reminder, between session one and session two, we have covered the following topics. If you were not able to join us for session one, it is archived on Cluin that you can go back and listen to. We also will be hosting this series again in the fall. But in session one, we talked about the CSM for BI mitigation, community engagement, rapid response and ventilation, remediation, and institutional controls. With today having us cover the active and passive mitigation strategies, and then Matt closing us out here with the system verification, O&M, curtailment, and shutdown. As a reminder, ITRC has several trainings available, especially on the vapor intrusion topic. We have the Vim sessions that we are here in today. Later this spring, we will be introducing an Understanding Vapor Intrusion introductory concepts two-part series as well. In addition, as part of the ITRC Vapor Intrusion Toolkit, the ITRC team put together a YouTube playlist that has several subtopics there that you can follow and watch existing videos to learn more. So with that, we are at our last Q&A break. I will put the link here on the slide back into the chat for anybody that needs to go in and fill out the feedback form. It's at the very bottom. Again, as a reminder, to get the certificate of completion, you must fill out the box that's in the lower right-hand corner that certifies you participated, and then the certificate is emailed to you. So I think I've stalled enough, and now I'm going to check in. Hopefully, Matt's had a chance to catch up on some of the Q&A, and I will take a chance to catch in. But anybody want to start us off with a question here?
I can kick us off with looks like there's an open one about the off-gassing from the asphalt latex membrane. Jay, it looks like you're, I don't know if you want to answer that verbally or typing. It looks like you're typing. But while you're thinking through that, I can answer the next question. Or maybe Stacy can help with it with that first question. But regarding the sub-slab vapor pins, we can use concentrations as data to assure the system is working effectively. Is there a certain amount of time you need to wait prior to sampling after installation and after system is shut down? Number one, yes, you can use concentrations to evaluate whether or not the system is working. The simplest way is you compare your sub-slab vapor concentrations to the conservative screening criterion. If they're below it, that could be a line of evidence that it's working. It might not be the only line of evidence, but that could be one. But it also is important to note that if sub-slab concentrations are above default screening levels, that doesn't necessarily mean the system is not working. That's when it comes into multiple sampling rounds, maybe additional lines of evidence to evaluate the performance of the system. If sub-slab vapor concentrations may be above screening levels. And the answer also depends on what kind of system you have. If you have a active depressurization system, a venting system, a passive system. So there's several things to consider, but the curtailment spreadsheet or fact sheet includes several considerations and questions to ask to evaluate if to evaluate to get into the answer to this question. And it intentionally does not provide one an answer because every site is different, every building is different, and mitigation systems are different, but it provides fundamental principles. To the second part of that question is what's the rebound? It's kind of getting at what's the time to wait before you turn it off and turn it back on. And it's analogous to rebound, kind of analogous to a rebound question for an SVE system. The answer is going to depend on your site. It's going to depend on your mitigation system and if it's active or passive. The timing may be the turnaround time between one and multiple sampling events may be shorter for a passive system than for an active system, because with an active system you're more directly physically influencing the subsurface, whereas a passive system it's less dynamic changes in the subsurface. So there's not a direct answer to how long exactly you have to wait, but the concept that's outlined in the fact sheet is that you can apply an approach such as you collect your first round of data, and then your second round of data, say for example, you temporarily turn off the system. So your second round of sampling data may be relatively close or recent to when you turned off the system, so that you're conservative. And then if you're still protective over that after that second sampling event, maybe the next event, you can extend the duration between going back out there and collecting data, for example. So those are kind of the concepts that are outlined in the curtailment plan to help get to that, to answer that question.
Jay, did you want to set up the other question and then get some feedback from the trainers here?
Sure. So there was a question. I'll just read it here. As an evaluation of the potential for off-gassing of VOCs or SVOCs from the asphalt-based liner been conducted? To the best of my knowledge, these liners are especially formulated specifically for the purpose of vapor mitigation. So I believe that they use very low or no VOC or SVOC blends. They typically liners or vapor barriers have material testing that goes along with them that the vendors provide as documentation for their products. So I'll leave it there. I don't know if Stacy wanted to add anything additional in to that.
Sorry, I was on mute. This is Stacy Burr with SEDCO. ALMs typically it's very negligible, especially once the ALM has cured, has been placed, and during the subsequent construction, those materials typically cure rapidly there too as well. So there is, to my knowledge, there's not been an overall study that I can point to for the to answer this question, but generally it's negligible depending on the type of the material.
Great, thanks. Glad when we can get everybody involved in responding to a question. Oh, jeez.
There's a question in there. Nicole, about is it best practice to avoid or target the placement of vapor pressure monitoring points near underground components or structures such as footings, manholes, or shallow utilities? I'm assuming that the question is regarding vapor pressure monitoring points that are installed during act for active mitigation. So I thought I'd
Go for it.
take it.
Go
Okay.
for it. Yeah.
Yeah, so and also, yes, that's right, Matt, you talked about this too as part of ongoing OM&M, and see if your answer is different than mine. It kind of goes back to the same concept as that dead zone question that came up during the active section. Certainly putting a point like right up against a footer in the middle of a building, may create a may be that you're putting the point in a dead zone, and what's the point? There might be a shadow right behind a footer where the vacuum mesh might not be as strong as it would be in the open space. So I like to put my vapor monitoring points at some distribution that gives me both data that's in direct line with the suction point and then gets me to a fairly good limit of the targeted area, especially if the targeted area of my system is not the full building. So I'm not gonna try to I don't know, trick myself and stick it right behind a footer and see if I got that exact at that exact location. But you certainly want to know, say there's a grade beam that goes down the middle of your building, or say you have two different foundations that were installed in a building at two different times. You certainly would want to put vapor monitoring points in both foundations, so that you, if your intent was to try to propagate vacuum from one foundation to the other, you can show that you did so. We're not trying to trick anybody out with these points. The point is to, make sure that the distribution is as you intended it to be. So I don't know if Matt, if you have other things to add.
Yeah, I think I'd say the same thing of you don't necessarily target right next to it just to find the shadow zone, but having a few representative points in areas of potential subslab discontinuities, as a general term, is an important thing to evaluate for your system performance. So you certainly want to consider the foundation features and having a sense of how it's operating around there. But you don't necessarily need to be targeting every single one of them by any means, or being right next to every single one of them.
Right. But it's good that you know those,
Exactly.
take some more time, because if you do know there's utility that runs, east to west across your building, and your suction point is south of that, and you don't have any north of that, you may realize that you have that utility corridor, for whatever reason, maybe because of depth or how it's made, is an obstruction to vacuum propagation. And so then you may need suction points on both sides of that utility corridor, for example. So knowing that you have these features would have already helped you design the system in the first place.
Oh, that's great information. All right, I accidentally selected a question I didn't mean to, so it might disappear. But are there any others out here that are open that you all would like to speak to? Otherwise, I think they're all captured.
I think we've covered, it looks like we've covered them.
I know, great job. Well, this was fantastic. Thank you to our audience, and especially to our trainers and our subject matter experts that have been back here responding to all of our questions. Made it through many. As a reminder, this training is recorded. It will be saved as an archive for later listening. You will receive an email as a registered attendee. If you would like that certificate of completion, again, that's through the feedback form at the very bottom. And it will be emailed to you. And if you'd like any further clarification on answers or additional questions, please feel free to email us at itrc@itrcweb.org, and we will follow up with our trainers to help you get your questions answered, as well as a reminder that all of this is based on the 2026 ITRC Vapor Intrusion Toolkit that has several, not just a gut technical and regulatory guidance, but also has the checklists, the fact sheets, and the tech sheets that the trainers here spoke of today. Thank you for joining us. I appreciate it, and we will talk to you again soon. Thank you very much, trainers.
Thanks.
Thanks, bye.